and critiques of calling out versus calling in, with debates on which method is most effective. These arguments are nuanced and complicated and include factors such as power dynamics, tone policing, respectability often expected from BIPOC, the nature of the relationship that exists between the person being called out or in and the person calling out or in, the level of emotional labor involved for BIPOC, the toxicity that can come with call-out culture versus call-out sometimes being the best and only approach available, optical allyship being employed. That all being said, what we are going to focus on today is not whether it is better to call out or to call in, but rather your reaction to being called out or called in. None of us are born fully conscious of systems of oppression or our own privileges and unconscious biases. We are also not born aware of the historical contexts within which we hold identities of privilege or marginalization. But because there is such a focus on being perfect and doing anti-racism perfectly and on being seen as a good person, people with white privilege often cause more harm when being called out or in because their white fragility causes them not to receive the feedback necessary to listen, apologize, and do better going forward. It is normal for any person who has been informed, whether through being called out or called in, that they have caused harm to become defensive, especially when causing harm was not intended. We all react the same way. Sweaty palms, accelerated heart rate, the warm wash of shame coming over us, as research professor and author Brené Brown calls it, feeling nauseous and an immediate reaction to want to stand up and defend ourselves by explaining our intentions. Believing we are under attack, our brains react quickly with a fight or flight response, causing a cascade of stress hormones to be released into our bodies. However, these feelings are more exacerbated during racial conversations because of the existence of white fragility, white superiority, white exceptionalism, and so on. While call-outs and call-ins never feel good, they are an invitation to become aware of behaviors and beliefs that are hidden to you, and they are an opportunity to do better so that you can stop doing harm and make amends for the pain caused. We have all had the experience of stepping on someone's foot or bumping into someone and immediately apologizing. It was not our intention to hurt them, but it is understood that the impact is still that harm was caused. Instead of refusing to apologize because we did not mean it, we rush to apologize because we understand we have caused pain. This is a very oversimplified explanation of what happens when we cause people harm. However, I find it useful as an easy way of understanding how, when we have caused harm, our impact matters more than our intention. So when we talk about being called out or called in, a common reaction by people with white privilege is to focus on their intention rather than their impact on BIPOC. This is a form of white centering, which prioritizes how a person of privilege feels about being called out or in versus the actual pain that BIPOC experience as a result of that person's actions, whether intentional or unintentional. How do reactions to being called out and called in show up? Here are a few examples of reactions to being called out or called in. Becoming defensive, derailing, crying, falling silent or dramatically leaving the space or conversation. Focusing on intent while ignoring or minimizing impact. Tone policing BIPOC by claiming you are being attacked or characterizing the person or persons calling you out as aggressive and irrational. Denying that your actions were racist because you do not see color, color blindness. Tokenizing BIPOC to prove you are not racist or talking about all the good things you have done for BIPOC, proving that these acts were actually optical allyship. Talking more than listening to the people calling you out or in. Focusing on how you can quickly fix things through optical allyship rather than really taking the time to reflect on your actions and do further research on what you are being called out or in for. Why do you need to look at being called out and called in? White supremacy, especially white superiority, white centering, and white exceptionalism, positions people with white privilege as virtuous, nice, and morally right. To be called out or called in feels like a dangerous attack against the individual and the collective identity of whiteness. It threatens you as a person with white privilege and the concept of white supremacy as a whole. And when the call out or call in comes from BIPOC, toward whom you unconsciously hold feelings of anti-blackness and racial inferiority, it is easy to dismiss, hold suspicion against, or simply not believe them. If you do not examine your own reactions to being called out or called in, then you will stay in a state of fragility, and you will continue to weaponize this fragility against BIPOC by centering yourself as the victim and refusing to apologize or change your behavior. This keeps white supremacy firmly in place. By continuing to focus on your intent and your feelings, you practice the belief that you matter more than BIPOC, that your feelings of discomfort about being called out or in matter more than the pain that BIPOC experience at the hands of racism. The fear of being called out or in is a dangerous deterrent to genuine anti-racism practice. If you are constantly afraid of doing the wrong thing and being called out or in for it, then your anti-racism work will easily slip into perfectionism, which will lead to white fragility, because you have not built the resilience needed for doing this work. Tone policing, because you can only handle being called out or in if the message is delivered to you in a certain tone. White silence, because of the fear of saying the wrong thing. White exceptionalism, because you will continue to think you are the exception to the rule, one of the good ones. White apathy, because you will think, what is the point if I'm going to be called out or in? Tokenism, because you'll want a BIPOC to protect you from the pain of being called out or in. Optical allyship, because you will be more concerned with not being called out or in than with simply doing the work. You will be called out or in as you do anti-racism work. Making mistakes is how you learn and do better going forward. Being called out or in is not a deterrent to the work. It is part of the work. And there is no safety in this work. There has been no safety for BIPOC under white supremacy. And the sense of perceived emotional danger that people with white privilege feel when being called out or in is so small compared to what BIPOC experience through racism. The questions today are these. When, not if, you are called out or in, are you well equipped enough to respond to it in a way that will help you learn and do better, or will you simply give in to white fragility and fall apart? Are you willing to do the work to set aside your unconscious beliefs around your racial superiority and exceptionalism and really listen to BIPOC with empathy and a desire to do better? Will you put in the work to educate yourself so that as you continue to grow and learn, you will do more good than harm? Reflective journaling prompts. 1. What have you felt, thought, said, or done when called out or in? How have you centered yourself and your intentions over BIPOC and the impact of your actions? 2. If it has not happened to you yet, how do you think you will react when it happens, based on your level of self-awareness, personal anti-racism work, and white fragility? 3. When you have been called out or called in, how have you handled apologizing and making amends? 4. What are your biggest fears about being called out or in? 5. Think back over the topics we have covered so far in this audiobook. What behaviors and beliefs most get in your way of being able to respond appropriately to being called out or in? Day 21. Week 3 review. This week, we covered behaviors related to the practice of allyship and how white supremacy can continue to be perpetuated in actions and behaviors that seem noble or neutral in theory, but quickly reveal a foundation of the racist status quo being maintained underneath. White apathy, like white silence, is a passive way of continuing to be complicit in white supremacy through non-action. White apathy says BIPOC are not important enough for you to show up, use your voice, and do the work. This collective lack of energy toward anti-racism and social change is what keeps white supremacy locked in place. White centering upholds white supremacy by maintaining the dominance of whiteness as the norm and by focusing energy on prioritizing the needs and desires of people with white privilege above everyone else. Tokenism, white saviorism, and optical allyship show us, on the other hand, that it is possible to intend to do the right thing while continuing to perpetuate white centering and white superiority. In exploring these topics, you have a greater understanding of how to show up in ways that do more good than harm. And lastly, because doing this work means you will make mistakes, we looked at how you react when being called out or in, and how to use these moments as opportunities to listen, apologize, become more educated about privilege and oppression, and do better going forward. Maya Angelou famously said, "Do the best you can until you know better. Then when you know better, do better." When it comes to racial conversations, that means beginning with the willingness to lay down white fragility and unconscious bias. Listen to the feedback being offered, even though it causes discomfort. Reflect on your actions and unconscious beliefs. Educate yourself, apologize, make amends through changed behavior, and do better in the future. Reflective journaling prompts. 1. What more have you learned about yourself and your unique personal brand of white supremacy? 2. In what ways have you realized behaviors you have thought were not that bad were actually very harmful? 3. Where are you beginning to see your biggest challenges when it comes to your personal anti-racism work? 4. Where are you starting to do your work, and where are you still holding back? 5. What other dots have you started connecting when reflecting on the work you have done so far? Week 4. Power, relationships, and commitments. In our final week together, we look at your relationships with other people with white privilege, as well as your personal values and commitments to anti-racism. Some of the days during this week are shorter than the ones we have covered during other weeks. This is because less explanation is needed about the particular topic, and more emphasis is placed on reflecting on your relationships with other people and your own commitments going forward. Over the last 3 weeks, we have covered a lot of different intersecting behaviors, beliefs, and dynamics that make up white supremacy. As we come into our final week, it is time to bring this learning together in ways that can best support you after completing this audiobook. Take a moment to review what you have covered so far, as it will help you to go deeper in answering some of the reflective questions. Day 22. You and white feminism. If feminism can understand the patriarchy, it's important to question why so many feminists struggle to understand whiteness as a political structure in the very same way. Rennie Edo Lodge, Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race. What is white feminism? As a feminist, I cannot complete this book without talking about feminism. In this context, we are talking about white feminism, or what you may have often considered mainstream feminism. I understand that each person has their own unique relationship, or absence of relationship, with feminism. Whatever your gender identity or the nature of your relationship with feminism, it is important to explore this topic and its ramifications on BIPOC. Let us begin with some brief definitions so that we have a common starting ground to build upon. Feminism is broadly defined as a range of political movements, ideologies, and social movements that share a common goal: to define, establish, and achieve the political, economic, personal, and social equality of the genders. White feminism is broadly defined as an epithet used to describe feminist theories that focus on the struggles of white women without addressing distinct forms of oppression faced by ethnic minority women and women lacking other privileges. White feminism focuses on the struggles of white women, usually cisgendered, over BIPOC. It is a feminism that is only concerned with disparities and oppression of gender, and it does not take into account disparities and oppression of other intersections that are just as important, including race, class, age, ability, sexual orientation, gender identity, and so on. White feminists will often ask BIPOC to set aside their race and issues with racism and instead band together in sisterhood under the issue of gender and sexism first. This request ignores two crucial points. One, white women do not have to consider the implications of their race because they have white privilege. Race is not an identity where they experience oppression. Rather, it is an identity where they hold power. To ask BIPOC to set aside their race is to ask BIPOC to act as if they are white. Two, to ask BIPOC to focus on gender before race is to ask them to put their different identities in a hierarchical order. But as a black woman, I am not black then woman. I am black and woman. My womanness cannot erase my blackness, and my blackness cannot erase my womanness. Under white supremacy and patriarchy, or what feminist author and activist Bell Hooks calls imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy, women of color experience discrimination because of both our race and our gender. The privilege of whiteness means only seeing yourself as a woman, if that is your gender identity, because due to white centering, you are seen as raceless. White women hold the expectation that black, indigenous, and women of color, by WOC, should stand in solidarity under the shared experience of gender discrimination. But as writer Mickey Kendall's viral hashtag points out, solidarity is for white women. And white solidarity in the feminist movement is not a new phenomenon. The Western feminist movement has marginalized BIPOC from its very inception. In the United States, the very first women's rights conference in Seneca Falls in 1848 failed to address the racism faced by BIPOC. In 1870, in response to the ratification of the 15th Amendment, which secured voting rights for men of all races, Anna Howard Shaw, president of the National Women's Suffrage Association, argued, "You have put the ballot in the hands of your black men, thus making them political superiors of white women. Never before in the history of the world have men made former slaves the political masters of their former mistresses." In 1913, before the first suffrage parade held in Washington, D.C., suffragist Alice Paul wrote in response to the idea that white women and black women march together, "As far as I can see, we must have a white procession or a Negro procession or no procession at all." And though white women received the right to vote in 1920 when the 19th Amendment was ratified, because of racial discrimination, women of color in some parts of the United States were subject to many restrictions that made it almost impossible for them to vote until the 1965 Voting Rights Act was passed. The feminist movement has, from its very beginnings, been an extension of white supremacy. It has marginalized BIPOC and expected BIWOC to fit themselves into a so-called universal feminism that is in reality white-centered. It is no wonder that many BIWOC find it hard to see themselves in the feminist movement, opting instead for black feminism, womanism, or no affiliation with the feminist movement at all. It is tempting to argue that these events were in the past and have no bearing on the current state of the feminist movement. However, feminism and the divide between white women and BIWOC still exist. Just like white supremacy continues to thrive today despite the granting of civil rights, mainstream feminism continues to exclude and marginalize BIWOC. And despite white women experiencing discrimination and oppression under patriarchy, white women also enact discrimination and oppression against BIWOC under white supremacy. This is a hard pill to swallow for many white women, but as we have explored extensively throughout this audiobook, white women have all the privileges and power that come with their race. Many white women who consider themselves feminists, but who have not engaged with anti-racism work with much depth, often become defensive at being called white feminists. Actress Emma Watson shared her experience of this in a letter to her book club, Our Shared Shelf, when she announced the first book of 2018, Reni Eddo Lodge's Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race. In the letter, she wrote, "When I heard myself being called a white feminist, I didn't understand. I suppose I proved their case in point. What was the need to define me, or anyone else for that matter, as a feminist by race? What did this mean? Was I being called racist? Was the feminist movement more fractured than I had understood? I began panicking." She then went on to share how her understanding had evolved. "It would have been more useful to spend the time asking myself questions like, what are the ways I have benefited from being white? In what ways do I support and uphold a system that is structurally racist? How do my race, class, and gender affect my perspective? There seem to be many types of feminists and feminism, but instead of seeing these differences as divisive, I could have asked whether defining them was actually empowering and bringing about better understanding. But I didn't know how to ask these questions." How does white feminism show up? Here are a few examples of white feminism in action. White feminists will talk about the pay gap between men and women without referencing the pay gap between white women and BIWOC. White feminists will tell BIWOC that talking about race is divisive and that we should focus first on being united under gender. White feminist spirituality culturally appropriates and whitewashes BIPOC spirituality. White feminists showed up for women at the 2017 Women's March, but do not show up in similar numbers for Black women and people at Black Lives Matter marches. White feminism largely ignores or is unaware of the Black maternal health crisis because it does not impact white women. White feminism centers white women leaders while undermining and betraying BIWOC leaders. White feminism ignores or excludes the groundbreaking works of Black feminist leaders like Kimberlé Crenshaw, Audre Lorde, bell hooks, Alice Walker, Angela Davis, or other non-white feminists. White feminism does not believe that Muslim feminists who choose to wear the hijab are real feminists. Why do you need to look at white feminism? White feminism is an extension of white supremacy. It is only concerned with white women gaining parity with white men, and throughout history it has shown that it will throw under the bus anyone who is not white to gain that parity. White feminism asks BIWOC to ignore their race and focus only on their gender. During a speech at the Women's Convention in Akron, Ohio, in 1851, Sojourner Truth said, "That man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and to have the best place everywhere. Nobody ever helps me into carriages or over mud puddles or gives me any best place. And ain't I a woman?" Truth was asking if her blackness made her less of a woman because she was not treated in the same way that white women were treated. And because of white supremacy, this still rings true today. Under white feminism and white supremacy, the only way for BIWOC to gain parity with white women would be to perform an impossibility, to make ourselves raceless in the white imagination. The antidote to the poison of white feminism and, by extension, white supremacy is intersectionality. Intersectionality is a term coined by law professor and civil rights advocate Dr. Kimberlé Crenshaw. It is a framework that helps us to explore the dynamic between coexisting identities and connected systems of oppression, particularly as it relates to gender and race and the experiences of Black women. Crenshaw explains, "Intersectionality simply came from the idea that if you're standing in the path of multiple forms of exclusion, you are likely to get hit by both. These women are injured, but when the race ambulance and the gender ambulance arrive at the scene, they see these women of color lying in the intersection and they say, Well, we can't figure out if this was just race or just sex discrimination. And unless they can show us which one it was, we can't help them. Intersectionality gives us a way of practicing feminism that is anti-racist. But intersectionality is not something that can be reached without a constant and unwavering commitment to anti-racist practice. Though the term intersectional feminism is now used to talk about how people are impacted by systems of oppression, not just gender discrimination and racial discrimination, it cannot be overstated that without a firm commitment to centering BIPOC, intersectionality is meaningless. As Crenshaw said during a speech at Tulane University in 2017, intersectionality has been gentrified in the sense that people to whom it was initially designed to recognize have been pushed out of the discourse. Women of color can't be completely pushed in the margins by an idea that was meant to demarginalize the margins. Reflective journaling prompts. 1. To what extent has your idea of feminism been under the issue of gender only? 2. How has your feminism neglected or minimized the issues of BIPOC? 3. How has your feminism rejected, discounted, or simply ignored BIPOC leaders? 4. How has your feminism been white-centered? 5. If you are someone who has called yourself an intersectional feminist, in what ways have you been centering BIWOC? Day 23. You and white leaders. If we don't challenge each other to use our platforms for better than our niches or what our quote-unquote brand is, what are we doing as influencers? If we can't activate our audiences at the times it's important or needed, then what do we have these platforms for? Lovey Ajayi. You and white leaders. Over the last 22 prompts, you have dug deep, exploring white supremacist thoughts, beliefs, behaviors, and motivations within yourself. For the next few days of the work, we are examining how these behaviors play out in relationships between you and other people with white privilege in your life, and those who have an impact on your life. Today, we are looking at you and white leaders, specifically people with white privilege in positions of leadership, authority, and power whom you come into contact with. Examples of leaders include teachers, coaches, mentors, authors, speakers, public figures, management at your work or other institutions, worship leaders, community leaders, project leaders, politicians, and so on. It also includes yourself if you are in a leadership position and your peers who are in leadership positions too. Why do you need to look at your relationship with white leaders? People with white privilege who are in positions of leadership have a great deal of responsibility. In addition to the white privilege that they already hold, they also have the ability to have a greater impact on how BIPOC are treated because their voice carries more weight and their authority means that they sometimes have the ability to create or influence policies and practices. Also, whether right or wrong, we often look to people in positions of leadership as role models of how to be in the world. However, we can also ask our leaders to do better. When it becomes clear to leaders that their audience, employees, community members and voters are insisting on change, then they will have no choice but to do the very work you are doing right now. But if everyone stays quiet, nothing changes. The more you do your own anti-racism work, the more you can influence white leaders to do their own work too. And the more that they do their anti-racism work, the more they will influence other people with white privilege to do their work too. Reflective journaling prompts. 1. Knowing what you now know about white supremacist behaviors across days 1 to 22, how do you respond when you witness white leaders behaving in these white supremacist ways? When white leaders tone police BIPOC. When white leaders claim colorblindness. When white leaders use anti-black tropes or racist stereotypes. When white leaders practice cultural appropriation. When white leaders practice optical allyship and white saviorism. 2. When you have witnessed white leaders practicing these behaviors, how do your own white fragility and white silence get in the way of you asking them to do better? 3. How does your fear of loss of privilege and comfort hold you back from asking white leaders to do better? 4. How aware have you been of whether white leaders you follow are doing deeper anti-racism work? How much of a priority has it been for you to push them to go beyond the visual effect of diversity? 5. If you are in a leadership position, how do you plan to respond to your own behaviors going forward? How do you plan to hold yourself accountable to doing better? Day 24. You and your friends. There is no social change fairy. There is only change made by the hands of individuals. Winona LaDuke. You and your friends. Today we are continuing to look at the personal connections you have and how you respond when you notice white supremacist behaviors playing out. Oftentimes there is a reluctance to rock the boat by calling in or out racism when you see it, or it is done in such a gentle and subtle way that it is essentially ineffective. In today's prompt, we're not just talking about your closest friends, as that can often be the easiest place to speak up. There is already built-up rapport, connection, and implicit understanding that the call in or call out is not necessarily received as a personal attack, although it can be. Instead, I invite you to cast your view out to all your friendships and acquaintance circles, your co-workers, your peers, other parents in your community, other students in your school, other worshippers in your spiritual community, other entrepreneurs in your business circles, other artists in your creative circles, family friends, your partner's friends, friends of friends with whom you have spent time, and so on. Why do you need to look at your relationships with your friends? In yesterday's topic, we talked about the influence we can have on our leaders. This influence is even greater with our friends. Because of your proximity to and relationship with these people in your life, you have an even greater possibility of being able to influence whether they engage in conscious anti-racism practice. In a similar vein, if you practice white silence and white apathy, you influence them to do the same too. Reflective journaling prompts. 1. How have you responded when you have witnessed racist words and actions from these people in your life? 2. How have you stayed silent or made excuses for them in your mind? 3. How have you thought it was not worth the hassle because of the discomfort of rocking the boat? Or how have you seen it as your responsibility to address it with them since you have more influence over them because of your friendship? 4. Are there certain people you feel more comfortable speaking up to than others? Why is that? 5. Are there certain people you continue to stay in friendship with, even though they are problematic and refuse to change? 6. How have you risked these relationships by calling in or calling out racist behavior, even if nobody was going to thank you for it? 7. How do you feel about your friends who are not doing their own personal anti-racism work? 8. What efforts have you made to invite your friends into doing anti-racism work with you? 9. How have you allowed your friends to influence you not to engage in anti-racism work? Day 25. You and your family. No one is born hating another person because of the color of his skin, or his background, or his religion. People must learn to hate, And if they can learn to hate, they can be taught to love. For love comes more naturally to the human heart than its opposite. Nelson Mandela. You and your family. I will preface today's topic by saying that everyone has family stuff. Everyone has family dynamics that range from hurt feelings to trauma and lots of family secrets. So bringing race and racism into these dynamics is a lot more complicated than with your friends or co-workers. However, your unique and complex family dynamics do not exempt you from doing this work in your family circles. BIPOC have complicated family dynamics too, and on top of that, they still have to deal with racism and white supremacy. Why do you need to look at your relationship with your family? As with yesterday's topic, your family is where you hold a great deal of influence. It is also the place where you learned, or did not learn, about white privilege and white supremacy. And if you are a parent, it is a place where you hold great influence over how your children, as people with white privilege, will practice or not practice anti-racism. Often, a lot of emphasis is placed on having the big talk with your family members about racism at annual events such as Thanksgiving or Christmas. However, this is not a one-time conversation. It is an ongoing one that does not just look at calling out the use of racial slurs or cultural appropriation, but that also includes deeper discussions on historical and cultural contexts that center whiteness to explore the subtle yet equally harmful white supremacist behaviors we have talked about in this audiobook, such as colorblindness, tone policing, white silence, white exceptionalism, and so on. With your more nuanced understanding of how liberal people with white privilege are also complicit in white supremacy from doing this work, you are in a powerful position to help your family members expand and deepen their own anti-racism knowledge and practice too. Reflective journaling prompts. 1. How do you feel about speaking up about racism and white supremacist beliefs and actions to your family members? 2. How have you excused or ignored your family members' racist behaviors because addressing them seems too difficult and you want to keep the peace? 3. How have you excused your elders' racism because they are from another time? 4. If you are a parent, how do you speak to your children about racism beyond "we don't see color"? How early did you or will you speak to your children about racism and white privilege? How early did your parents or caregivers speak to you about racism and white privilege? 5. What racist beliefs have you internalized from your family? 6. To what extent do you place white comfort over anti-racism in your family? 7. What are some of the ways in which you can begin to have deeper conversations with your family about racism? 8. How do you allow perfectionism to get in the way of having racial conversations with your family? 9. In what ways do you, or can you, organize your family to show up for BIPOC in your communities? Not from a place of white saviorism, but rather by volunteering at and donating to anti-racist movements and organizations being led by BIPOC in your communities. Day 26. You and your values. Never forget that justice is what love looks like in public. Cornel West. You and your values. There are now only 3 days left of this work. However, as you will have come to realize by now, this work is lifelong. So in these last days, we're going to look at some areas to help you prepare for staying committed to the work after these 28 days are over. Today we are looking at you and your values. Our values are the principles and standards that guide how we live our lives and where we choose to place our energy. Our values are our personal set of beliefs that determine our actions and what is most important to us in life. Our values are often a mixture of guiding principles we have chosen for ourselves and those we have adopted through conditioning, whether societal or religious. Why do you need to look at your values? Owning white privilege and being conditioned by the system of white supremacy mean that you have some subconscious values that are white supremacist in nature. These values can actually clash with other consciously chosen values that you have. For example, being conditioned within white supremacy means that one of the values that you likely have is about white superiority. The idea that as a person with white privilege, you are more worthy and deserve to take up more space and resources than BIPOC. At the same time, however, you may have a chosen value that says that you believe that all people are equal and deserve to be treated equally. These two sets of values are at odds with each other and cause you to act in ways that contradict who you think you are and what you believe you value. Throughout this audiobook, we have been exploring this idea of what it means to be a good white person. By now, many of you have realized that clinging to this notion has actually done more harm than good, because it has prevented you from doing the real work. When you are so focused on making sure that other people know that you are not racist, you simply continue to practice racism through behaviors like white exceptionalism, tokenism, optical allyship, and white saviorism. As you come to the end of this audiobook and look at your values, I invite you to define for yourself what it means to be good as a person who holds white privilege. I invite you to release the desire to be seen as good by other people and instead explore what it looks like for you to own that you are a person who holds privilege and that you are a person who is committed to practicing anti-racism. Reflective journaling prompts. 1. To what extent have your values helped your ability to practice anti-racism? 2. What contradictory values do you hold that hinder your ability to practice anti-racism? 3. What new core values and beliefs do you feel you need to integrate after doing this work in order to better practice lifelong anti-racism? 4. How has your desire to be seen as a good person with white privilege prevented you from actually being good? Day 27. You and losing privilege. Whiteness is an advantage and privilege because you have made it so, not because the universe demands it. Michael Eric Dyson. Tears We Cannot Stop. A Sermon to White America. You and losing privilege. We're coming full circle now. When you first started this audiobook, day one was all about you and white privilege. Over the last 26 days, you have explored what that privilege means in ways that you have probably never done before. You have been able to see how your privilege has harmed BIPOC. You will also have begun to realize that in order for change to happen, you must lose some of that privilege. I'm not talking about using your privilege for good in some sort of white saviorist super ally kind of way. This is not about rescuing or saving BIPOC by becoming a voice for the voiceless. Rather, I am talking about the privileges, advantages, and comforts you must be willing to let go of so that BIPOC can have more dignity in their lives. White privilege is a bubble that protects you, rewards you with unearned advantages, gives you the belief that you are entitled to be in all spaces all the time, shields you from showing up for BIPOC, and grants you a feeling of authority and power. Why do you need to look at losing privilege? While the work we have been doing here is important in helping you to deepen your understanding and knowledge about privilege and racism, without actually relinquishing some of that privilege, nothing changes. Being willing to lose privilege looks like taking responsibility for your own anti-racist education with the free and paid resources already publicly available instead of expecting BIPOC to do that work for you. Talking to your friends and family members who have white privilege about practicing anti-racism. Having racial conversations with other white people, whether in person or online. Donating money to causes, movements, and organizations that are working toward liberation and dignity for BIPOC. Paying money to more BIPOC businesses, entrepreneurial ventures, and projects. Amplifying BIPOC voices, whether or not their work is about racism and social justice. Showing up at protests and marches for BIPOC. Calling out or calling in leaders, organizations, and institutions that are discriminating against and doing harm to BIPOC. Continuing to show up even when you are called out, you feel discomfort or fatigue, or you are not rewarded for it, socially or financially. Taking up less space and allowing BIPOC to take up more space so that they can be heard and their leadership can be followed. Risking relationships and comfort by speaking up instead of staying silent. Reflective journaling prompts. 1. In what ways will your privilege need to change in order for you to consistently practice anti-racism? 2. How will you need to change the way you take up space for and with BIPOC? 3. How will you need to show up differently for BIPOC? 4. What risks must you be willing to take? What sacrifices must you be willing to make? 5. What comforts must you be willing to lose? 6. In what ways will you need to take greater responsibility? 7. How will you need to de-center whiteness and the white gaze? 8. How will you need to lose privilege and safety in your friendships, workspaces, businesses, families, spiritual communities, and other white-centered spaces? 9. Are you willing to lose your white privilege after everything you've learned here? Day 28. You and your commitments. The relevant question is not whether all whites are racist, but how we can move more white people from a position of active or passive racism to one of active anti-racism. Beverly Daniel Tatum. Why are all the black kids sitting together in the cafeteria? You and your commitments. We are at the finish line of this audiobook, but certainly not at the finish line of the lifelong work of anti-racism. Take a moment to check in with where you are right now. How are you feeling? I imagine that many different emotions are running through you by this day, from exhaustion and heartbreak to inspiration, determination, and more. Perhaps you have more questions than answers. This is normal. When our perceptions have been expanded to see things we have never seen before, it is normal to want to recreate a feeling of stability and certainty by finding some clear and solid answers. Understanding the burden of white privilege and what it means to be personally complicit in the system of white supremacy is a lot to hold. Holding that burden and really being with that truth is an important part of the work that people with white privilege must do. BIPOC have been holding the burden of what it feels like to be oppressed and marginalized their whole lives and back through their ancestry for generations. The devastation, anger, and confusion you are feeling are part of the work too. Without those feelings, nothing changes, because there is no reason to heal what does not feel broken. I invite you not to run away from the pain, but to allow it to break your heart open. Superficial attempts to heal racism, like colorblindness, tokenism, and white saviorism, protect you from having to feel this pain. Doing the inner work and going into the truth blasts away all the lies and games, giving you a real opportunity to create change. There is no safety in this work. There is no clean, comfortable, or convenient way to dismantle a violent system of oppression. You must roll up your sleeves and get down into the ugly, fertile dirt. What you have uncovered over the last 27 days can no longer be hidden again. You cannot go back to sleep. You cannot unsee and unknow what you now see and know. And if you were to choose to do so, you would be worse off than when you began this work on day one. Now that we have come to the end of this audiobook, the question is, how are you going to stay committed from day 29 onward? This question is actually one I want you to consider revisiting on a daily basis, because all the learning and aha moments in the world do not mean anything if they are not followed through with committed actions for change. 2 days ago, we looked at your values, and yesterday, we looked at what you are willing to lose in terms of privilege. Today, we are looking at what commitments you are ready to make to practice lifelong anti-racism. Please note that I am not talking about making promises. You cannot make promises that you will inevitably break. And you will break them because to be human is to make mistakes, to forget, and to want to revert back to what is known, safe, and comfortable. And white privilege is a great source of comfort and safety. But what you can do is pledge commitments and take actions on those commitments. And you can re-pledge daily and take actions daily. So even when you slip up, forget, and regress into old white supremacist habits and behaviors, you can re-pledge to your commitments and begin again. Anti-racism is not about perfectionism. It is about the intention to help create change met with a consistent commitment to keep learning, keep showing up, and keep doing what is necessary so that BIPOC can live with dignity and equality. Reflective journaling prompts. 1. Write 3 concrete, out-of-your-comfort-zone actions you are committed to taking in the next 2 weeks toward anti-racism. These could be uncomfortable conversations you need to have, significant changes in your life you need to make, someone you need to call out or call in, sincere apologies you need to make, announcements you need to make, organizations you need to begin volunteering at, etc. Make these actions as specific as possible. What, where, when, how, who, why, etc. And also make clear how you will be held accountable for these actions, e.g., choose and notify an accountability partner. 2. Starting today and over the next week, begin to write down your commitments to this work. Craft a commitment statement that you will be able to refer to every day, and especially on the days when you forget, make mistakes, or begin to slip back into white apathy. Your commitments are not what you will try to do or hope to do, but what you will do. To craft this document, go back through all the days of this work and recall the ways you have done harm and the ways in which you are committed to change. Think about what you are ready to commit to in your personal life, your family life, your friendships, your work and business life, and your community life. Use any or all of the following writing prompts to help you craft your commitment statement. I am committed to showing up for this lifelong anti-racism practice work because I am committed to challenging my white fragility by I am committed to using my voice for anti-racism work by I am committed to challenging racism in other people with white privilege by I am committed to uplifting, supporting, and centering BIPOC by I am committed to financially supporting the following BIPOC movements and causes. I am committed to decentering myself as a person with white privilege by I am committed to continuing my lifelong anti-racism education by I am committed to the following values that will help me to practice anti-racism. I am committed to breaking through my white apathy by I am committed to showing up even when I make mistakes by I am committed to using my privilege for anti-racism by I am committed to challenging my optical allyship by... I am committed to being a good ancestor by... Commitments are strong statements of solidarity and action. They are not guarantees that you will actually do the work, but they will help focus you so you know what work you are supposed to be doing. Commit to this lifelong work. Write it down and then live your life accordingly. To ensure that your commitment statement does not become a symbolic document that pays lip service but does not follow through with action, keep it somewhere where you will be able to see it every day. Do not just leave it in your journal. Post it up in your home and or workspace where you will be able to access it every day and be reminded of what you are committed to. If working through this audiobook with family members or co-workers, consider creating a family or organizational commitment statement too. To create accountability, share your commitment statement with a person or persons in your life who are also committed to social change and anti-racism work. Keep one another accountable to showing up in the ways that you have committed to. Do not let one another slip back into the behaviors we have explored in this audiobook. Remember, you do not have to write it all down today. Begin today, but continue this over the coming days, weeks, months, and years. Your commitment statement is not a solid document set in stone. Treat it as a living, breathing, evolving, and ever-deepening statement that reflects your own growth in this work and your commitment to anti-racism as a lifelong practice. There is no end to what a living world will demand of you. Earthseed, The Books of the Living One, Verse 21, Octavia Butler, Parable of the Sower. Now what? Continuing the work after day 28. After 28 days of reflective journaling and inner excavation, you now have a strong foundation to continue moving forward in your practice of anti-racism. In addition, you also have an extremely valuable resource, your journal of writing, within which you have unpacked each day's prompts. Your writing has revealed to you what you needed to see about your personal complicity and relationship with white supremacy. What do you do with this journal? Keep it with you and refer to it again and again when you need to re-examine how white supremacy shows up for you. Also, recognize that this journal gave you a first layer of revelations. There are many more layers to go. As your awareness has now expanded to become more conscious of how, and not if, racism is at play, you will see even more how white supremacy plays out within you and within society. To get to these deeper layers and to unpack even further, buy yourself a new journal, and when you are ready, begin the 28 days again. Use this audiobook as a resource for you to take responsibility for doing your own work. See it as a tool in your metaphorical anti-racism backpack. Tips in supporting you in continuing to do your work. Return to the reflective journal prompts again and again, as needed. Go deeper each time. Dig out more so that you can do less harm. Seek out anti-racist educators and teachers. Attend their classes, courses, workshops, and events. Self-reflecting is important, but it is not enough. Put yourself in spaces where you can learn directly from anti-racist educators. Make curating your anti-racism education and following through on your actions your responsibility. Find articles, podcasts, books, publications, and other resources to expand your understanding of historic and present-time oppression. Make lifelong learning about anti-racism one of your values. Check out the resources guide that accompanies this audiobook as a starting place. Show up at meetings, rallies, marches, and fundraisers for BIPOC. Show up, period. Financially support organizations, nonprofits, and political candidates who are working hard for BIPOC rights. Uplift, center, pay, and elevate BIPOC leaders and teachers. Uphold your commitments to living your life with integrity for your anti-racist values. Live these commitments daily. Moving from the personal to the systemic. This internal work you have been doing of examining, reflecting, changing, and acting differently is just one prong in the work to dismantle white supremacy. For real change to happen, you must also challenge systems and work to create structural changes, dismantling white supremacy institutionally as well as personally. It is hard to imagine what a world without white supremacy would be like. A world where BIPOC get to live with the same level of dignity and humanity as white people. And yet we must continue to work toward it. White supremacy is the paradigm we have come to accept as normal. But normal does not make it right. It never has. Even though this personal anti-racism work is just one prong of the dismantling of white supremacy, it is incredibly important. Systems do not change unless the people who uphold them change, and each person is responsible for upholding the system. So it is your responsibility within yourself, your communities, your educational institutions, your corporations, and your government institutions to do the work that you can do every day to create the change the world needs by creating change within yourself. A final note. I began this audiobook by telling you about my purpose, which is to become a good ancestor, to leave this world in a better place than I found it, for my children and for everyone else who is and who will be impacted by my being here on the planet today. As we close up our time together, I want to speak to the good ancestor who lies within you, the person inside you who came to this audiobook with questions about dismantling white supremacy and who leaves this audiobook knowing that you are a part of the problem and that you are simultaneously also a part of the answer. There is great power and responsibility in that knowledge, but knowledge without action is meaningless. To dismantle the system of oppression and marginalization that has hurt so many for so many generations, we need all of us. In creating a new world, everyone's contribution matters. And as someone who holds white privilege, your contribution to this work is of the utmost importance. No matter who you are, you have the power to influence change in the world. The effects of your actions, whether consciously chosen or not, will impact everyone who comes into contact with you and what you create in the world while you are alive. You can continue to unconsciously allow white supremacy to use you, as it used your ancestors, to cause an impact of harm and marginalization to BIPOC. Or you can intentionally choose to disrupt and dismantle white supremacy within yourself and your communities so that BIPOC can live free of racism and oppression. The choice is yours. The moment is now. Help change the world. Become a good ancestor.
This concludes the reading of Me and White Supremacy, Combat Racism, Change the World, and Become a Good Ancestor by Layla F. Saad.